Hi, can you hear me? It's on? Great. Thanks for inviting me to come up and speak to you about some of the things that we do at the Mayo Clinic. I'm a relatively new member of the Mayo Clinic. I moved there about a year ago. I was at the University of Calgary before that for about 10 years, and before that I was at the University of Western Ontario for about 5 or 6 years before that. And my career has been focused on applications, applying technology from computer science and mathematics in medicine. So I like to say I'm a jack of many trades, a master of none. So this will be very much an applications-focused talk, as you will see. I have a disclosure there at the bottom you can read if you'd like. I have been involved in some commercial activities, transferring technology, some of which I'll talk about today, into the medical realm through a company that I founded. Okay. So I'd like to talk to you today about something that we're focusing on quite a bit. We've got a group at the Mayo Clinic. The Mayo Clinic, just a little bit of background. It's the largest private not-for-profit healthcare organization in the world. Has about 55,000 employees, 55 to 60,000 employees, and they're growing. They have three major sites. The main site is in Rochester, Minnesota, where it was founded, and that's probably got about 50,000 employees. And then there's a major site in Phoenix, where I am. And there's a major site in Jacksonville, Florida, and then they have various health networks. And the three shields of the Mayo logo represent patient treatment, education, and research. So research is a really big deal at the Mayo Clinic, and they invest a lot of their own money. Since they're a nonprofit, anything that they generate has to go back into the organization each year, and a lot of that comes through research funding. So it's quite an interesting place to work. They have their own graduate school, and they have their own medical school, of course. A lot of my work is actually done in conjunction with Arizona State University in Phoenix, and I didn't realize till I started looking into it that Arizona State is actually the largest university in the U.S. It has about 75,000 students, and they're going to grow that to 100,000 students in the next couple of years. So it's a big university, and that, as far as I'm concerned, that's great because it means lots of graduate students to draw from. Don't know if I'd want to go there as an undergrad. I'll find out when my 12-year-old gets a few years older. Can imagine the first-year calculus course probably has 5,000 students. Anyway, so today I'm going to talk to you about imagenomics, which is a phrase we've coined to talk about the merger of imaging and genomics. And it wasn't too long ago that I was very skeptical long before a term like this even came up, when a clinician colleague of mine came to me and asked me if we could see patterns in images or quantify them because they were relevant to his diagnostic process. Based on a study he'd done earlier with some radiologists, they looked at these images and they sort of came up with semi-quantitative scales, and they looked for patterns in these images which turned out to be related to genetic characteristics of a brain tumor in this case. And those genetic characteristics are quite important for determining how to treat the patient. But the radiologists, when they looked at these images, only got the genetic prediction of basically yes or no, did it have this trait or not. They got that prediction right about two-thirds of the time, and that wasn't quite good enough for his clinical use. So he came to me and asked, you know, is there something you can do that would be better, that could help us improve it? And we did some work. I'll show the results. We used the Stockwell transform to analyze texture in these images, and we were able to build a classifier that operated at over 90% accuracy. So that was quite quite positive. And that sort of really opened my eye. And it turns out people have been doing this all around the world for the last, well, probably maybe even up to 10 years, although most of the work has been in the last couple of years, I would say. So even though I had a question mark, I think now, I think it's pretty reasonable to assume that at least in some applications you will see patterns in images. And remember, medical images are at the scale of millimeters, and we're probably not ever going to get much better than that and retain a practical clinical device. And genes, of course, are, you know, micron, they're subcellular. So how can it be possible that an alteration in a gene could be seen at a spatial scale of millimeters? well, probably a change in one gene, unless it's a pretty critical gene, wouldn't be visible. But a lot of the things that happen in cancer in particular are massive genetic changes. So that colleague of mine, what he was looking for was deletion of an entire allele of a chromosome. So we're talking literally tens of thousands of genes being wiped out. And you can imagine that something like that might, in two lesions, one with the allele and one without, that at a spatial scale of millimeters, it might cause them to grow differently. And this has really come to the fore. This is the cover of the American College of Radiology Bulletin, and this is sent out to everybody who does work in radiology in North America, pretty much. So very widely distributed. And the cover article in January of this year was on imagenomics, and the caption there says, why genomics matters. So they're starting to put forward that not so much now, but in the future, radiologists are going to have to look at images and try and give their referring colleague, the specialist that's referred them for the test, some information about the genetic characteristic of the lesion. So right now, if you go and do a literature search and look at what's been done, typically now they'll have a group of radiologists sit down and look at a single image exam, and they'll come up with a very semi-quantitative scale. It will be things like, is there a ring enhancement, yes or no? Is there speckle in the lesion, yes or no? How irregular is the edge of the lesion on a scale of 1 to 5, with maybe 5 being very irregular and 1 being very smooth? So it's sort of semi-quantitative and fairly subjective. And I think that to really move this forward, we're going to need to combine all the information, because typically patients will come in and they'll get a CT and an MRI and perhaps a PET, maybe in the same day or maybe in the course of a few weeks while they're undergoing treatment. And certainly because of treatment, there'll be the before and after. They'll want to see the effects of treatment. So we'll have many images with many contrasts. We need to have objective, reproducible, and reliable metrics that are quantitative. And to get there from where we are now, I think three things are really important. And micro-local analysis of images actually plays in all three of them. So I'm going to talk about the three things. That's it, just three things. So the first of these has to do with combining images. So a patient will come in. Here's an example. This is a patient who had two scans on the same day, probably about 15 or 20 minutes apart. A CT, which is just rendered here in green, and an MRI, which is rendered in red for visualization purposes. And if you superimpose those two scans, you can see they're not aligned. The coordinate system is completely different. And if we can merge them or align them on top of each other, we now have additional information about each spatial location. And that's the goal. And in this case, the CT scan provides information about bone, and the MRI provides information about soft tissue like blood and nerves. So it could be very important for a surgeon, for example, to have both. So the process typically is you look at information in the images. And this is an area, I'll explain it in a minute, where I think microlocal analysis could help quite a bit. So typically it's an iterative process where you take a guess and you do a series of operations, translations, rotations, and scalings, and you try and bring those images into alignment. And the algorithm can actually be broken down into four steps. We have a red image, a red volume on the top. We're going to call that the moving image, and we'd like to bring that into alignment with the blue volume on the bottom. And the first step is to apply a transformation. In this case, a simple affine transformation. We'll limit ourselves to a simple affine transformation. And then we need to resample it onto the same grid spacing as the target image. And we do this from the source always in each iteration so that errors don't accumulate. And then the key of the algorithm really is the similarity metric. And this is where I think microlocal analysis could really be beneficial. To my knowledge, things like Stockwell transform and local assessment of texture has not been used here in medical applications. But you go through and compute some measure of similarity based on the characteristics of the two volumes, and then you pass that off to an optimizer, which takes another step through the parameter space. So with a simple affine transformation, we might have as few as 6 or as many as a dozen parameters that we're trying to optimize. And this is repeated hundreds, if not thousands, of times before you converge on a solution that you feel is adequate. And your similarity metric can tell you when to stop, or you can have a fixed number of iterations. If you do sort of rough back of the envelope calculations, you're looking at about a teraflop of computations to perform this alignment, given the typical sizes of medical image volumes, although those are increasing dramatically. So the required computations are increasing as well. And it would be very nice for the clinician if this could complete in about a second. That's about the amount of time that they have. They're not going to wait even a minute. A minute is way too long. A second would be nice. So what we did several years ago is go to computer gaming graphics cards. This is already out of date, this plot. It only goes to the beginning of this year, and new processors have been released. The point is that with these graphical processing units, or GPUs, they double in compute power about every 10 months, and they vastly outstrip the compute performance of the processor inside your computer. This is the current high-end card. We just got one of these in the lab a couple weeks ago, and the NVIDIA GTX 690. It has over 3,000 processors on it, each operating at a gigahertz, and 4 gig of very, very high-speed RAM. And this is actually capable of almost 6 teraflops by itself. So this is the, and it costs about $1,000 right now, which is actually kind of expensive for these graphics cards. It'll come down in price. And you can put several of these together in a single computer and have them operate as a single card. So it's, you know, not unimaginable to get 10 teraflops of compute power and 8 gigs of very high-speed RAM inside your PC. The problem, of course, is programming it. An analogy we like to use, we use often, is cooking. If you're a chef, and your goal is to make, you make your living producing cakes, let's say, in a bakery, the more cakes you can produce in an hour, the more money you can possibly earn. So in your kitchen, do you want a chef like Jamie Oliver helping you, or do you want 105-year-olds in your kitchen? Well, the CPU is Jamie Oliver, and the GPU is the 105-year-olds. And to marshal the 105-year-olds and not have your kitchen turn into a total disaster is quite challenging, especially when there are natural blockages in the algorithm or constraints like the bag of flour or the oven. You have to figure out how to schedule those things. And it's very, very interesting, some of the algorithms that have been developed, even in the last decade, that you realize now are classic algorithms in the sense that a bubble sort or a Q sort is a classic algorithm in computer science that will be used for 100 years. Some of the algorithms that have been developed in the computer or massively parallel programming are classic, and you know that 100 years from now they'll still be used. So the three components of this, not the optimizer, but the other three components actually fit fairly nicely on the GPU, and we're able to accelerate this. This is a result from a couple of years ago, actually, and this is running on an iMac, and it's not a large volume. It's 256 squared by about 100 slices. It's an MRI taken at two time points in a clinical trial of a patient with multiple sclerosis. So one volume's in green and one volume's in red. And when I just click on the start button here, that's how long it takes to bring those two volumes into alignment. So it's about a second. And what you see in the middle is the similarity metric being calculated. So here it is in 2D. There's the similarity metric. It happens so fast that it's hard to watch. So even with a large medical volume now on that new processor that we have, this is happening in about a second. So we're there. We're at the point where we can take a medical image volume and align it with pretty good results, at least in the brain, which is a symmetrical and it has this skull around it, which prevents it from deforming too much. In the brain, you can do it in about a second pretty easily on a common computer. What's interesting about this is a slice from that study I just showed you. If you scroll through, where things are similar, they're shown in gray, and where there's differences, they're shown in green or red. That's just a display algorithm that we produced. And this shows differences between the two volumes in a visual way that's nice for the clinician. So here, this red blush, I don't know, you know, you can see it in the image on the left, there's a bit of a red blush. Those are new MS lesions in this patient that are only present in the second scan. You can imagine these would be a lot tougher to see if you had to look at the images side by side with different cuts through the brain. So once we've combined these images, CT to PET to MR, and merged them all together, we have a very interesting high-dimensional data set. We've got three spatial dimensions, but then perhaps several intensity dimensions. The next thing we need to be able to do is to measure or identify regions of interest inside these images. And this is a brain scan. This is a MRI scan of a patient who has a brain tumor. And that white cloud appearing object or structure in the top left of this image is the tumor. There's a solid white structure that looks almost like a butterfly wings in the middle. That's normal. Those are the ventricles. They're filled with cerebral spinal fluid, and that's present in all of us. But that grayish white blush in the top left is abnormal tissue that should not be there. And it's actually compressing this patient's brain. It's causing the center line to distend. And this is actually a pretty advanced brain tumor that in all likelihood ended up killing this patient. So one of the things that they need to know is the effectiveness of treatment. And one of the ways they do that is by measuring the volume of the lesion. After radiotherapy, did it grow or shrink or stay the same? And currently, what they do in clinical practice every day, in all the clinics that I've worked, including the Mayo Clinic, this is standard practice. They scroll through the stack of images until they find what they feel is the largest cross-sectional extent of the lesion, and they draw two orthogonal lines like this. The first one is the largest extent of the lesion, and the second line is perpendicular to that. And sometimes they don't even draw the second line, to tell you the truth. Sometimes they just draw the first line, and that's it. And so you'll get a measurement, you know, I saw this not too long ago in the stroke clinic. It was a patient who had a massive hemorrhage in their brain, which can kill very quickly, again, because it swells and compresses the brain. And so the decision they have to make is, do we cut off a quarter of the skull and flip it open and let the brain grow out so it doesn't compress and kill the patient? And then after the bleeding stops, the brain will subside, and they'll put the skull back and sew it up. But there's a huge risk of infection with that, because you're exposing the brain. Even if it's in the intensive care, there's still a risk of infection, and the surgery is invasive. So it's a tough decision to make, and they make the decision based on how fast the lesion is growing. And they had two scans taken about 25 minutes apart, and in the first scan, the radiologist said the lesion was 3 centimeters. That was its volume, literally. On the report, it said the volume of this lesion is 3 centimeters. And on the second scan, it said the volume of the lesion was 3.2 centimeters. And when you looked at the two scans side by side, you could see that parts of the bleed had shrunk and parts had grown, and it was a very irregular, looked somewhat like this. So based on that information, 3 and 3.2, you have to decide whether you're going to do this potentially lethal operation or not. So that is the standard of care in many hospitals today in the Western world. They often will sometimes plug the numbers that they make into a little formula, and it's pretty easy to see that they're measuring an ellipsoid. And so that's their approximation of the volume. The reason this is done is because it's fast. Sad as that may seem, they just don't have the time. They don't have the time to spend measuring this more accurately, even in life and death situations. It's just not done. We'd like it to be fast, accurate, and precise. In research studies, they'll have an expert, like a neuroradiologist, sit down and outline the lesion by hand, slice by slice. This takes a long time, but it turns out when you have an expert who knows what they're doing, they're very accurate, actually, and they're also very precise. If they repeat the measurement or another expert comes in and makes the measurement, they get very similar measurements. What we and other people have been looking at is a technique called a level set, which you may or may not be familiar with, but basically you put an initiating surface in there, and the surface expands or contracts, it can do both simultaneously, according to underlying image properties. And also, it takes into account the surface tension. So you can have an adjustable surface tension, and you can think of it as inflating a balloon, and the stiffness of the balloon is variable. And this is done by solving a series of partial differential equations along the surface at each step. And this is another area where I think microlocal analysis could be very beneficial. I'm not aware of work using things like Stockwell transform or curvelets to try and determine whether something should be in or outside of the object or to affect the stiffness of the surface locally. It would be a very interesting a problem. Of course, because you're doing all these calculations, it takes a long time, but it has very nice properties. It tends not to have holes in the inside because they're regions of high curvature, and it can be fairly reproducible. So we actually figured out how to run this on the GPU. We weren't the first group to do it. Oh, the surface tension is a user-adjustable parameter. Some implementations it may be, and implementations that we've developed, it's a universal parameter for the algorithm. Yeah. there's a speed function you bury. The speed function has two terms, one which is a growth term and one which is a stiffness term, and you just vary between the two. We implemented this on a GPU, and what was interesting about this was we looked not only at the spatial continuity, the spatial derivative, to try and limit the computational domain. We introduced the concept of looking at the time derivative to limit the computational domain. And this reduced the computational domain by about a factor of 20 and resulted in a factor of 16 acceleration over the best previously published algorithm on a GPU. And that, and we also were able to prove that the algorithm is both work and step efficient. And if you're a GPU programmer, what that means is it does no more work than the equivalent serial algorithm running on a serial processor. And it step efficient means if you add more compute processors to the problem, it will scale across them in a linear fashion with a constant out in front. So as the graphics cards get more powerful, this algorithm should scale fairly well. And so we tested it clinically. We had three experts perform measurements using each of the techniques I outlined, with the current clinical diameter method outlining by hand and using our level set. 450 repeated measurements on patient scans that didn't change. And this is to assess accuracy and reliability. So from the consensus manual measurements, we get an estimate of the true volume. And we can compare the other two techniques, the diameter and the level set, to that. The level set tracks very nicely with the manual measurements, our best estimate of truth, better so than the diameter method. In terms of speed, the level set is actually, these numbers are all significantly different from each other. The level set is slightly faster, only 15 seconds on average, but the key is that it's no worse in terms of time than what they do now clinically, so that's really nice. And it's about a factor of 8 to 10 faster than manual outlining. And in terms of precision, these numbers indicate the smallest real change that we can measure. So if a patient comes in and they have their lesion measured with a level set, between the current, the last measurement and the current measurement, if we see a change of in volume between 4 and 5 centimeters, we're 95% confident that's real. It's too large to be explained by measurement variability alone. So a smaller number here is better. So you can see that the level sets are on par with the manual measurements from the experts. So what we've done essentially is combine the benefits of the speed of the current diameter method with the accuracy and precision of the manual method. Here's an example on one of the patients. This is our research tool. This is just a simple volume rendering of this patient's brain, and we'll cut into it here. From the top, it's that white mass that you see there, that's the brain tumor. That should not be there. It's fairly heterogeneous inside, and when we put down an initiating, it starts to grow immediately, and then here we're just adjusting the simple window and level of what we consider to be involved. And you can see how it nicely fills in, there are no holes, so it's much different than a flood fill that you would see in an image editing program like Photoshop. And if you miss some of it, you can add to it or you can adjust your parameters. So there, the lesion is segmented, they're happy with it, and then they can do a visual check in 3D to see that it looks reasonable. There's no leaks or anything untoward. And when they're happy with the measurement of that lesion volume, they can just click on the check mark and it'll report the volume in mils. So 63 mils, the volume of that lesion. So it's pretty simple and pretty quick to make an accurate and precise measurement using this technique. We compared it to, it's several hundred times faster than state-of-the-art CPU algorithms that are available in the public domain for comparison. Okay, the third thing that I'd like to talk to you about. So now we've got a whole bunch of images of a patient. We've merged them into the same coordinate system, and we're able to identify pathology in perhaps normal regions. Now we want to learn something or try and probe this to learn something about patterns in the image inside the lesion and perhaps in normal tissue and how those compare with the underlying genomics of the disease. And for this we've turned largely to the Stockwell transform. And you've probably seen this many times this week, I'll repeat it, but basically the Stockwell transform is the Fourier transform of a windowed function. You can see here, and the window, of course, is the critical part. It's also a function of time and frequency. So we have a Gaussian that we use to isolate a component of the signal and then perform a Fourier transform on it. And doing that, we can build up time frequency or a space frequency domain, as you're undoubtedly more familiar than I am. So when you do this in two dimensions, you get a four-dimensional data set. You essentially get a Fourier domain for each spatial location. So if we pull a pixel out of this MRI of a brain tumor, you can think that there's essentially a Fourier domain, and imaging physicists call this K-space because of the two variables that they use to index this domain, KX and KY. So they call this K-space, it's a Fourier domain, and we have one of those of the same size of the image, n by n, for each spatial location, so four-dimensional data structure. This makes it very difficult to interpret for a clinician, for example, or to extract information out of it. So there have been a lot of research on how do we reduce the dimensionality of this data set while trying to maintain information. And one of the first things we did many years ago was just to simply integrate this frequency domain in rings to produce a plot of power versus spatial frequency, and we call this the texture curve. It reflects patterns in the image. Now, if you have if you superimpose a delta function on that image, the two things that will impact that texture curve are the distance, of course, to the pixel and the amplitude of the delta. So as you have a strong delta, if it's far away, it can have an impact on the low frequency components. As it gets closer and closer to the pixel of interest, it'll start to move, if you will, to the right of this curve and have an impact on the higher spatial frequencies as the Gaussian windows start to see that artifact. So there are advantages and disadvantages to this, but as a first pass, it wasn't too bad. So with this texture curve, what we would do then is just simply take this information, and you can see how it changes here. In a region that's relatively smooth, this is a MRI scan, the red box shows a relatively homogeneous. There's very little power at the high spatial frequencies, and in a region with more complex anatomical structure, there is power at the high spatial frequencies. And you can put these boxes down in normal and abnormal regions, or in two tumors, one that has a certain genetic pattern and one that doesn't, extract these curves and feed them to a machine learning algorithm. This is essentially what we did initially, and have this algorithm see if it can learn based on the spatial frequency profile differences between the diseased and normal state or genetically positive or negative state. And then the goal would be to, once you build this model, to use it to predict unknown samples. Before you do that, though, you need to have an estimate of its accuracy, its performance, sensitivity, and specificity. And you can just use a leave one out process to test this. And this is, in the machine learning community, this is known as the most rigorous test, because if you have outliers, you're guaranteed to encounter them as the test subject. Whereas if they're included in the train group, the fact that they're an outlier will be averaged out. So as you iterate through, if you have n samples, there are n iterations of this algorithm, you're guaranteed to hit the worst cases. And this will give you an estimate of your accuracy, sensitivity, and specificity, and that actually is publishable in the medical literature. What's a lot more difficult is then to go and take a model that's been validated this way and do it in a completely unseen trial. So none of the cases were used in the training. They're all just used in the testing. And because it would be a clinical trial, it would involve a lot of time, effort, and money. So this has not been done, to my knowledge, yet. So all these results that I'm showing are based on leave one out cross-validation. And this is the work that I mentioned originally. The word at the end there, oligodendroglioma, is a type of brain tumor. And it has it responds or does not respond to treatment based on its genetic profile, and it's missing an allele of a gene. So a massive genetic alteration. And one of our co-authors, the second from the last, Gregory Cairncross, is well known. He's a neuro-oncologist. He's well known in that community for discovering why it is that some patients responded to therapy and some didn't, and it's because of this massive genetic change in the cells of the tumor. And he's the fellow who came and asked me, could we detect this more rigorously? So we applied the Stockwell transform, just like I showed, and we were able to go from the radiologists around 66% accurate in predicting the underlying genetic characteristic, up over 90% accurate, being able to predict the underlying. And in medicine, the rule of thumb is 80% and above accuracy is clinically useful, and when you get above 90%, you quickly become the gold standard. So doing a tissue biopsy, a brain surgery to take a piece of tissue and then doing the genetic assay is about 95% accurate. 5% of the time, they miss the tumor, they don't get enough tissue, or an error happens during the processing and they don't get a definitive result. So nothing in medicine is ever perfect. So once, like I said, you get above 90%, you're quickly closing in on gold standard territory. So every percentage point of accuracy in that decade between 80 and 90 is critical. Here's an example published later where we looked at this is glioblastoma, which is the nasty brain tumor. This is the bad one. Well, they're all bad, but this is the worst. And methylation of this MGMT is a critical factor for determining the probability or likelihood of response to one of the mainstay therapies. So the degree of methylation is important. And they just asked us to predict whether it was methylated or not, a binary variable. And again, we're able to get into the mid-80s, I think around 86% accurate. So probably clinically useful. It would be nice if we had a couple more percent on that, but that's the best we were able to do. And it was a sample size of about 60 patients. This is in cancer. It was the changes in the brain for multiple sclerosis, being able to predict damage. We co-registered brains, looked at when the first lesion appeared in the radiological exam, and because they were co-registered in time, we could propagate that region of interest backwards in time and start analyzing the tissue before the lesion appeared, and were able to show that there were changes detectable with the texture before the radiologist called a new lesion in the patient. So that could be interesting in clinical trials. This is more recent work. A big problem in cancer of all types, and particularly brain cancer, is a problem they call pseudoprogression. So a patient will come in and get treated, and then in the follow-up scan, which may happen a couple weeks later, the lesion looks a lot worse. It's bigger, it's more inflamed. And sometimes this is because the treatment is working, and there's an immune reaction going in there and cleaning up the dead cancerous cells. And sometimes it's because the treatment is not working and the tumor is just growing aggressively. And radiologically, they look the same. They look very similar. It's a very tough problem for a radiologist to look at a post-treatment scan, especially post-radiotherapy scan, and determine whether the lesion is responding or not. So typically what they have to do is just wait it out. They wait a couple of months, and then physiologically, you learn from patient symptoms whether the treatment is working or not. So a big goal is to reduce that time, so if you can determine it almost immediately that the treatment's not working, you can switch to another therapy. And time is of the essence in a lot of these aggressive cancers. So we've accelerated the mathematics to the extent that all those previous examples, we basically got one assessment per lesion. Now we can do one assessment per pixel, essentially. Because we've been able to reduce the computational requirements of this. So we can paint a map, and this is, again, looking at the space frequency distribution in this lesion and coming up with a measure of heterogeneity, and then color-coding that and painting it on top of the lesion. And you can see that, and this is proved out in the statistics, that the degree of heterogeneity is highly correlated with whether this lesion is responding or not responding to treatment. So there's something happening internally in the structure of the tissue when it's growing versus when it's breaking down due to the radiotherapy. And we're able to detect this in a way that radiologists are not. Here again, we're over 90% accurate, but a small sample size, only 20 patients, 10 of each type. And truth is known because they progressed physiologically. So those are the three things that I wanted to talk to you about. First, we want to merge images. Need to do it in about a second, and then combine them in some way to provide a powerful visualization for the doctor. The second thing we need to be able to do is to make fast, accurate, and precise measurements of normal and abnormal pathology in these scans. And the third thing is to mine this high-dimensional spatial and contrast data set to see if we can see patterns that correlate with interesting genetic profiles. And for that, I'm a real big proponent of microlocal analysis and machine learning. So pull information out using microlocal analysis and then use a machine learning tool to try and build a classifier that will operate at high accuracy and sensitivity and specificity. And then, of course, you need to go on. The big task for the medical community would be to go on and validate this in clinical trials. But I do have one more thing I'd like to show you, one last thing, and this we haven't published on this yet, but I thought I'd show it. It might be interesting to some of you here today, and it has to do with the Stockwell transform, of course. Here, this is a brain tumor, and in the left, we've had an expert sit down and outline the perimeter of this tumor. So it's the inside of this and probably a region around its edge, because the tumor infiltrates into normal tissue farther than you can see in medical imaging. So we'd like to analyze this region and produce some kind of an assessment. And the plot that I'm showing on the right is the average, it's the upper quadrant of the space frequency domain for this entire region of interest. So we've averaged it all together to produce this plot. And it's not scaled very well, but there's lots of information there about the spatial frequencies. The issue is that it takes almost 10 minutes to compute this, even on a modern, pretty good computer, multi-core, using all the cores. And that's way too long, especially for just a single slice. So what we'd like to be able to do, of course, is to reduce that time. So we've been working on a new transform over the last couple of years. And this is the output from the new transform. They look almost the same, but if you actually subtract them, and this is the difference multiplied by two, there's a little bit of difference at the low spatial frequencies, but mid and high spatial frequencies are very, very close. In fact, the accuracy is, with its sort of default settings, are up above 95%. Accurate, or the differences are less than 5%, and most of those are the low spatial frequencies. And this takes just over 2 seconds to calculate now. So we've accelerated the Stockwell transform by a factor of 200, and we're able to compute the entire fully redundant domain. So this is not using like the discrete orthonormal Stockwell transform. It's essentially a new transform. We call it the fast time frequency transform, or FTFT, and produces similar results. Another issue that you have often in medical imaging has to do with rotation and translation. So if we pick a particular point in this image, you can see the upper quadrant of the local space frequency domain there. If the image is rotated, here we just rotated it and recalculated that domain, of course you get a rotation. Rotation in the spatial domain is rotation in the Fourier domain, and it's rotation in the Stockwell domain as well. But the problem comes if you do something like, say, integrate in rings, like we have done in the past, to produce a space frequency curve, a texture curve for machine learning. If you look at this, the action of rotating the image reduces the power, so the filtering and whatnot and rebinning appears to reduce the power, but even more importantly, it redistributes it, and this shouldn't happen. We'd like to have a rotationally invariant form of this transform. Patients will be rotated all the time. You can't guarantee that their orientation will be the same. So if we're going to compare scan to scan, this means we have to go through and correct for any rotation differences. So our new transform actually handles this fairly well. It's essentially rotationally invariant. The difference here is typically around a 1% difference in the power between the two domains, and its distribution remains essentially uniform. So we have a very fast transform that we can calculate, and it provides rotational invariance. So I'd like to show it to you. I'm just going to load a medical image. This is a brain cancer, and I can actually click here now and drag in real time, and you can see that the domain there, the semicircle plot, is the upper half of the space frequency domain. We can calculate this in real time as we drag the pixel around. And down below are two curves related to the power distribution in this domain that we can use for machine learning. So we can now generate this in real time. And this is running on my MacBook Air, so not a powerful processor at all. This machine has 4 gigs of RAM, so it's not... And if we want to calculate a region of interest, I'll just draw a region over the tumor here. We'll say OK. And this will, now it's going off and calculating, and there's the spinning beach ball. It's going off and calculating the domain for this, all the pixels inside this ROI. And that took about 20 seconds to do that. on a MacBook Air compared to 10 minutes on a pretty powerful computer. So, and this has some interesting characteristics. We do something like this. I don't know how well you can see it, but we have now a whole range of characteristics, and we're actually replicating all of the, I don't know how many of you are familiar with texture analysis, but one of the most common algorithms used is Herlitz co-occurrence matrices, and you can calculate all sorts of statistics like entropy and whatnot. We can calculate all that from this as well. So we think, you know, and one of the issues with Herlitz co-occurrence matrix is in practical application, you only look at pixels that are nearby because the dimensionality of the problem grows as you look further away. So most applications that you see published essentially are only looking at the very highest spatial frequencies. With this application, we're looking at a much broader range of spatial frequencies, and yet we can provide many of the same metrics that they use for classification. So if you just look at like a spatial frequency band, you don't get much information about that lesion. And, you know, this is the lowest spatial frequency. When you go up in spatial frequency, you can start seeing more information. And that's essentially what we were using before to try and classify the lesion. Now we've got much more sophisticated metrics that we can use, like this guy. What's this one here? You know, there the lesion essentially already segmented it by using this characteristic. So we're hoping that we can use this for lots of other applications coming up in the future. So thank you very much for your time and attention today. No, it's completely different. Completely different. No, I can't tell you what it is. Unfortunately, we're trying to get the paper out. Editing the math and whatnot, trying to get it out. All I can tell you is that it's fast. Yeah. So actually, most of the computation, when I loaded that image in the tool, most of the computation was done while it was being loaded. That's how long it took. So you don't really notice the computation from the load time. And in one dimension, we've been able to analyze signals that are tens of thousands of samples long in real time. Yeah, we have other ways. That's just a simple way of reducing it. And looking for new methods all the time. Like, in, you know, there's lots of really interesting things presented at the conference here about how, you know, you get ideas about how you might do a better job of trying to reduce the dimension of the data while maintaining the information as much as possible. You know, and taking into account the structure of the space frequency domain. It's not a random function at all. And also, I suppose, the fact that we're probably not too much interested in the lowest spatial frequencies in medicine.
Any other questions? Sticker again?
Okay.